Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The son of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi threatened rivers of blood, and that's what the government has brought down on hundreds of protesters. But Gaddafi's 41-year rule seems to be faltering. Joining me in the studio to talk about this situation, David Schenker of the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute, Robin Wright of the United States Institute of Peace, and Libyan-American activist Nejla Abdurrahman and Asma Megharef. And you can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Mm-hmm. Nejla, if I could start with you, what is happening in Libya today that we know?
Well, what we're seeing in the Western press and also in Al Jazeera is that in the eastern part of the country, it seems that the security services and the military seem to have vanished. That's what they're reporting. I don't know what the case is. From our contacts on the ground, they seem to corroborate that. It seems that they've actually overwhelmed any of the forces that are there, have taken their weapons in many cases and are now armed and defending themselves. We received our little organization received, we were up monitoring the news all night long. We received some text messages from some friends in Benghazi, and they were very excited messages. And basically, it was one person saying, Libya is free. We are free. So we don't really know what the situation is all over the eastern part or even all over Benghazi. But it seems that people are starting to become very excited about what's going on. And of course, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 days. But from what we're hearing from people on the ground, they seem to corroborate what we're hearing in the news.
And Robin Wright, what have you heard about the force being used against protesters?
Well, there are several reports that Gaddafi has brought in foreign mercenaries. And we have a very different situation in Libya than we did in either Egypt or Tunisia, where the professional militaries refuse to fire against the protesters. And this was clearly decisive in the decision of both President Ben Ali of Tunisia and President Mubarak of Egypt to step down from power. Mubarak has brought in his own forces. And the military in Egypt, in Libya, has always been different anyway. And so you have the dynamics, the kinds of pressures, very different on Muammar Gaddafi.
And Nejla, what are you hearing from people back home?
From Tripoli, the story is very different. And the most difficult thing is that there's no way to know what really is the situation throughout the city. You have certain parts of the city near the center of the city, near the Green Square, and areas around it, Bin Ashur, Sugujuma, these different areas, where they've seen sort of the brunt of the security forces' attacks on the protesters and the most losses of life and the most bloodshed. And so we actually received an email from a friend who is living in Bin Ashur, which is adjacent to the downtown area. And it was a terrified email. She hears planes overhead. She hears gunshots. We recorded an interview with her. She played the gunshots for us. She says that people are she doesn't leave her house, but from what she hears, people are really being slaughtered out there. We received a phone call from a friend who is a doctor in a Tripoli hospital, and again these are eyewitness reports. I have no way of corroborating what is being said, so let me just say that before I tell you what he's telling us. But he's a doctor there, and from what he told us, people are the morgues are full, the hospitals are full, the blood banks are empty, security forces are coming to the hospitals, taking people's names, taking victims' names. So you can, you know, draw whatever conclusions you want from that. Shooting people in the hospitals. Also, apparently, this is what this particular
shooting
doctor...
Shooting in the hospitals.
In the hospitals, intimidating doctors, shooting victims in the hospitals. From what the doctor told us, even going into the blood banks and taking the blood out and pouring it out.
And Asma Megarev, do you have family in Libya?
I still have family members who live in Benghazi. That's where the city that started the uprising against Gaddafi. And we have friends, of course, in Tripoli and in Beida and other areas. And we've been getting the same sort of eyewitness testimony and reports, people who are frantic, talking about bodies that are on the street. And if anyone tries to touch the bodies or retrieve them, they're being hit by sniper bullets. And let me touch on something that Robin talked about in terms of the issue of the military in Libya and how it's different than Egypt and Tunisia. Very early on, the military was very strong in Libya, but because most of the coup attempts that happened against Gaddafi, for example, Omar Maheshi, Adam Hawaz, and Mohammed al-Mgariyev, all of them came from the military. Gaddafi was very swift and very repressive and violent in his response to these coup attempts. He executed all of the officers. Anyone who was related to the officers or friends with the officers, he killed all of them. Even those who had prison sentences that were 10 and 15 years, instead of commuting them, he actually changed the sentence to a death sentence. So very early on, he marginalized the military. He made sure to replace the heads of the military with people who had some kind of allegiance to him through tribal connections or what have you. So and in the process also, he trained and groomed these paramilitary groups and forces that are specially trained to kill people, to torture, imprison, and kill people. And those are the forces that are taking, killing most of the protesters there on the streets. We are seeing that a lot of members of the military are actually siding with the protesters, especially in the eastern parts. Many of them are joining the protesters against the foreign mercenaries and against Gaddafi's forces.
And turning to you, David Schenker, the AP is reporting that key Western nations have urged the UN Security Council to demand an immediate end to Muammar Gaddafi's bloody crackdown and do strongly condemn the violence. What can the UN do at this point?
Well, if we can get some unanimity or some consensus, which I think there appears to be, people are talking about the potential for some sort of no-fly zone, a la what they had in Iraq decades ago and years ago, where these helicopter gunships, which are attacking civilians and airplanes flying over and bombing civilians, would be grounded by a UN force. I don't think anybody's talking about putting in any type of ground forces, but people are bantering around this idea of the no-fly zone, which I think you could get a lot of people backing that, particularly not only for the reasons of bloodshed, which are, you know, it's appalling, but for economic reasons.
But how do you support, how do you enforce a no-fly zone?
Well, like we did in Iraq, we get an international coalition and then likely Western forces, likely the U.S., would be flying planes over Libyan airspace to ensure that planes don't take
off. Robin, how possible is that?
It might be possible, but I think that Muammar Gaddafi has taken a stand now, and it's life or death, and politically anyway, and possibly physically too. He has clearly ignored all international advice. He had a long conversation with the UN Secretary General, who warned him about the dangers of pursuing this track, and, you know, gave him some pretty strong words, according to all accounts. And Gaddafi historically has not listened. He is a man who listens only to his inner voice. After all, his regime was associated with Pan Am 103 and the downing in 1988 of a Pan Am jetliner that was one of the most heinous acts of terrorism in modern history. And he just seems, he is a unique character. I've interviewed him twice. And he comes across as someone who doesn't live in our world in terms of his code of ethics, his standard of behavior, the things that set him off. I've often wondered if a psychiatrist or a psychologist mm-hmm. wouldn't have a field day with him, because I think that it goes beyond just eccentricities. But this is a man who has set on a course, and unlike what we've seen in Egypt and Tunisia, it's all or nothing with him. And I think they've gone so far in the massacres, leaving bodies on the street, using foreign military, using helicopter gunships, opening up on streets, not knowing who the protesters are or not, people who are going out to try to get food, that Libya is no longer a viable country. He's lost part of the country physically, and his economy is no longer viable. Look at the oil companies pulling out some of their workers. This is not a regime that is in any mode to compromise, and if it does, it's finished.
Asma.
Also on that issue, you're absolutely right, Robin. He has repressed his own people. He has masterminded terrorist attacks against his own people and internationally. The Pan Am 103, the French airliner, he has destabilized regimes around him in the region, Chad, Liberia, Uganda, you name it. And he's been behind a lot of the training for the Darfur rebels as well. He's been implicated in that. But the issue is, unfortunately, in the last several years, he has been, he feels that he's been given a green light to continue, because we are very keen on having a stable and secure region at the expense of human rights, unfortunately.
Asma Megharev, a D.C.-based Libyan human rights activist. Short break and right back. And here is our first posting on Facebook from Liz. I would like to know, she says, where he can find refuge. And since the Libyans have been seemingly so disorganized in their opposition, how can they quickly organize themselves for running the government, Robin?
That's the question in all of the Middle East countries. The opposition, whether it's liberal, leftist, Islamist, whatever, has been so marginalized, outlawed, exiled, or executed that there aren't easy options. People who emerge, civil society's been so weak. And Libya may be the best example of that. It's a very small population. Even though it's 17th largest country in the world, there are only 6.5 million people. And they're very divided along old tribal lines. There are divisions within the country. So it's not going to be an easy solution finding out who takes his place if and when he steps down.
And, Nejla, here's a question for you submitted from Robert, who says, will the National Army attempt to defend the citizens from the mercenaries that the government has hired to silence their protests?
Well, like Esma was saying earlier, the military is a little bit different than the security forces. So we have seen in certain places, in certain cities, soldiers, military, aligning with the people. In other places, not. I'm not sure if you saw on Al Jazeera television, they actually showed bodies, burned bodies lined up in rows. Presumably what the reporters were saying were these were soldiers who had refused to fire upon their own people, and so they've been showing that footage, and it's absolutely horrendous. But there are definitely many soldiers in the military who are refusing to fight against their people and who are
joining them. David Schenker.
Yeah, there were reports yesterday that the head of the military was put under house arrest because he refused to give orders to open fire in the crowds. Certainly, it's a very dangerous situation, particularly with these paramilitary security apparatus so affiliated with the regime. For among other reasons, the more atrocities they commit, the more implicated they are in these atrocities, the murders of Lebanese of the innocent people of Libya. They have no recourse. They have to go forward because if they lose, they will be hung and they will be held accountable.
There have been complaints that the U.S. has not done enough. What do you believe the U.S. should be doing, Najla?
I mean, at this point, I believe that they should be demanding unequivocally that he leave Libya. I know that's a very strong statement, but everybody has seen the video last night, his quote-unquote statement to the Libyan people. Everyone has seen how absurd it was. We don't need to really describe it in detail here or attempt to analyze
it. But for those who have not seen it, he was holding an umbrella.
Right. So he was in some... It's hard to describe whether he was inside, outside, in a studio.
He seemed in a Jeep.
Yeah, he was sort of sitting on the door, sort of hanging out of the door of a Jeep with an umbrella. There was a man holding a microphone, holding an umbrella that looked exactly like his umbrella. A couple drops of water coming down, and he said that he had wanted to speak with the youth in Green Square tonight, but unfortunately it was raining, and so he couldn't. And then also not to listen to the media and refer to them as dogs.
Perfect.
And also said, I'm not in Venezuela, I'm still in Tripoli.
And isn't there another statement expected today?
Oh, we're expecting a statement from today. But in terms of your question about the White House and its response, we've been getting a lot of responses from people inside the country who are saying, where's the White House? Where's President Obama? They're not expecting a lot, but they're expecting at least a statement of condemnation, the same that happened in Egypt and Tunisia. In 5 or 6 days of protest and uprising in Libya, we've had more killings than in 2 weeks in Egypt, actually double the number. And we saw that the White House, despite its very strong relationship with Mubarak, they were debating about, is he a dictator or not? There was some kind of a debate. There was going back and forth about how to term this and how to respond to it. But with the Libyan issue, a lot of people are just surprised. And Libyans are educated. They've read about the civil rights movement here in the U.S. They were so inspired by President Obama, the first African-American president, to be elected to the office. And they see that there is no response from him. And that's very shocking for many of them, disappointing.
Robin.
Well, the United States has far less leverage over Libya than any other country. We've only sent out a full-time ambassador since 2008. This is a country with which we've had longstanding tensions. In terms of aid, we only send $1 million, and it's largely for the dismantling of its weapons of mass destruction program. So, and the reality is that one of the reasons the U.S. renewed relations, one of the reasons that they got off the terrorism list was because it renounced terrorism and it gave up its weapons of mass destruction because the Europeans rely heavily on Libyan oil. There was an interest in engaging with Libya, finding some kind of compromise, but no one ever made domestic human rights issues a focal point. And now that the Libyans have risen up against Gaddafi, it finally has become something that the international community wants to give at least lip service to. Now, the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday put out a very strong statement condemning Libyan atrocities and behavior and making note of the death toll. The next step will obviously be something from the White House, but a statement from President Obama, unfortunately, is not likely to carry the same weight it does on someone like Mubarak. It may signal to the supporters or those sitting on the fence in Libya, yes, this is something that's backed, but it's not going to be decisive in the way that it was in either Tunisia or Libya.
David Schenker.
No, I think that's right. The Bush administration made a deal with Libya, essentially focused on WMD. And that was the priority, to denude them of the chemical biological weapons and the nuclear primarily. Human rights wasn't part of the deal. And I think, you know, the Obama administration too has been, you know, late to the game. We saw in 2009 Fatih Al-Jami died essentially in a prison, or he was, you know, sent to Jordan in a coma to die. And the administration came forward with a statement welcoming the release of Fatih Al-Jami to Jordan, and he died as soon as he reached Jordan. This should have been reason to condemn Libya rather than praise them.
But now we've heard about diplomats resigning. We've heard about soldiers leaving their posts. How serious is that for the regime, or can they just ignore that?
Well, this is not a regime of institutions. Certainly they have personnel. This is a problem certainly for PR for them. I think more pressing for them is what appears to be a momentum of losing tribal support within Libya, not from traditionally the East or Sirenaica, where you had opposition to Gaddafi from 1969, people who were monarchists supporting the monarchy, didn't like when Gaddafi came in. But now you're seeing this in the West. You have reports of the Warfala, one of the largest tribes in Libya, deciding that they can no longer back Gaddafi and that he has to leave.
Now, Asma, your dad was a diplomat. He left his post under Gaddafi in the 80s. How did you feel when you heard what these diplomats were doing?
Well, my dad was Libya's ambassador to India, you're correct. And he resigned his post in 1980 because at that time there was the height of the clashes between Gaddafi's revolutionary committees and people, students on college campuses. He was executing people publicly in college campuses and leaving their bodies to hang for days. And he was targeting intellectuals. And some of them were my dad's friends. So my dad decided that he's had enough. He opposed Gaddafi, announced his opposition to him. And we had to flee. And basically, we were hunted down by Gaddafi's agents. But let me say something. I applaud the position of Libyan ambassadors and diplomats who are deciding now to oppose Gaddafi publicly. And this speaks of the fragility of this regime. It's only been able to maintain its hold on power for so many years using violent repression against its people. And when people see that the regime is crumbling, they start abandoning ship, basically. And it also speaks of the fact that there are many people in the government who are not necessarily directly involved in killings and torture and imprisonment. Their hands are not stained in blood, and they're still on the fence. And that's why I'm saying the statement by President Obama is very, very important. It's not about what effects it's going to have. It's about supporting human rights, which is a pillar in the U.S. foreign policy, regardless of the consequences, whether or not it's going to be effective. This is going to send a very strong message to the Middle East and its people. It's going to win their hearts and minds. It's going to undermine Al-Qaeda and any appeals by terrorist groups. And this is an important strategic policy of the U.S., so we should look at it from that perspective.
Nejla, what kind of role is social media playing in this revolution?
Well, within Libya itself, I would have to say not as large of a role as it's played in Egypt, for example. Egyptians in Egypt were a lot more connected to each other, a lot more organized than Libyans in Libya, for sure. Many of the Libyan youth probably found out about February 17th, about the planned day of protest that had been announced a few weeks earlier through Facebook. But my hunch is that it is these social networks, these actual physical social networks, the word of mouth, that sort of transfer the information among people. And so at the very, we Libyans watching from the U.S. wondered really how many people were going to actually go out onto the streets on February 17th. We were wondering, a lot of us had doubts that people would really go out. Some of us thought that they would. And so what you had was you had small groups converging sort of randomly, groups of people who knew each other in the East. And then slowly they started to coalesce into these larger groups and snowball. And I think people saw people going out, and then it sort of just built from there. But I don't think social media in the country played such a huge role.
And isn't that part of what worries the United States and other Western countries? If Gaddafi does finally move out, who is there to take a position of leadership, Asmi?
Well, you know, there have been references made to tribal connections, and people, I think, focus more on divisions and differences between tribes. And tribal connections in Libya are very significant. These are informal networks of allegiances that basically hold groups of people together. But we've seen that those tribes are actually working together today. And that's an example of a positive element that we as Libyans can use and utilize in the post-Gaddafi era. We've seen that in areas that have been, quote-unquote, liberated from Gaddafi in the east, the protesters are very organized. They are protecting public offices and buildings. They are maintaining order. They're preventing people from looting. And if anything, it's indicative of the fact that people feel so united, this renewed sense of solidarity and unity among Libyans that is unprecedented. And we should definitely take advantage of that.
Asma Megharef, she's a D.C.-based Libyan human rights activist, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. And first to Sue in Rochester, New York, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I think the guests should be certain that they say that they are expressing their own opinions, because we don't know what is happening behind the scenes diplomatically. And I would also go back to Mr. Obama's speech in Cairo, which I think reset and made very clear what the Americans' position was in the Middle East specifically. And we don't see any American flags being burned over there. And I think that is really one of the reasons. So there may be a lot more than they know that's going on behind the scenes diplomatically within the administration.
Right, Ben.
Well, look, I'm not sure there are many American flags in Libya to burn anyway. The interesting thing about all of these upheavals is that they are not, unlike the Iranian Revolution, for example, aimed at foreign policy issues, aimed at cutting off relations with the West or anti-American upheavals. This is very much everywhere about whether it's jobs or dignity or respect for free elections. This is about domestic issues. And on the issue of President Obama's Cairo speech, look, it was a good speech. So was his speech in Indonesia and in Turkey. President Bush gave a very good speech in 2003 on democracy, in which he named specifically Egypt and Saudi Arabia and then did nothing. The real challenge for every administration, and this dates back 60 years, has been to take their words beyond speeches and to do something on the ground. And this is where the United States has repeatedly floundered, in part because we needed some of these countries strategically or economically, and we were unwilling to take actions that might lead to instability. And it's only in the aftermath of Tunisia's uprising and Egypt's uprising that you began to see a position that solidified behind human rights issues. And that now President Obama has clearly taken the toughest position of any U.S. president on these issues. He still may have a ways to go in terms of dealing with the specifics of Libya. But in terms of standing on the right side of history, he has made that shift, and it's been echoed throughout the administration.
Najla.
So the caller brought up Obama's speech. I've read Obama's address to the Egyptian people over and over and again, and in it he affirmed the United States, and I'm quoting directly here, commitment to governments that reflect the will of the people. He said that all people, American or non-American, want the same things: want to live in dignity, want employment, want education, want freedom, want democracy. He also called for less talk and bold action, the need to act boldly. But we're not seeing any of that now. So I'm wondering now if it was all just sort of hollow rhetoric. And yes, the caller is right. There probably are things going on behind the scenes, and it's difficult to speculate about those things. But regardless, we still have to call for action on the part of the U.S. government.
David Chenkman.
Yeah, I think that the president got a little bit of bounce out of Cairo. But by and large, things went back to normal. And we did look at, I think the administration looked at the interests and said, well, Mubarak's our guy. Even during the Cairo speech, he talked about democracy. He didn't talk about democracy in Egypt. I think it rang hollow to many people.
So now how are other countries in the region reacting to what's going on in Libya, Robin?
Every single government in the Middle East is nervous, and not just among the Arab countries. It's true of Iran, and I think it extends well beyond as well. There is a fundamental shift. The momentum today is on the side of the majority. What we're seeing transpire is not just the transfer from one man to a government, but from elites to the people.
Robin Wright, chief journalist, author, foreign policy analyst at the United States Institute of Peace. Short break and right back for more of your calls, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Harlem's been called the capital of Black America. In the last 400 years, the former Dutch village became a cultural mecca and the site of violent riots. How Harlem has thrived and struggled through the centuries. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Here's a message on Facebook from David, who says, I'd like to hear guests discuss the possibility of a Libyan civil war and whether foreign intervention on the anti-Qaddafi region Benghazi would be a possibility and who would intervene.
To be honest with you, I think this uprising has really united many Libyans, as I said earlier. I've been watching videos on YouTube, and my friends this morning have been sending me videos. Their brothers are sending them from Tripoli, telling me, please post it on YouTube. And on these videos, there are these young men in Tripoli who are chanting on the streets last night and in support of Benghazi and saying that Libya is one country. I think Gaddafi, for many decades and years, has attempted to play the card of regional division, and his son certainly 2 days ago in his nationally televised speech tried to intimidate people and use scare tactics and say that if you allow the uprising to continue, that the country will be thrown into a civil war. And we're seeing that actually many Libyans feel united more than before. Mm-hmm. And I've been hearing about truckloads of protesters who are going to the West and trying to save people in Tripoli. So I have high hopes for Libyan people. And those regional divisions have only been created by Gaddafi and maintained by Gaddafi.
Here's an email from Cincinnati, Ohio, from a person who says, as an African, I am appalled and ashamed to learn that most of these foreign mercenaries came from sub-Saharan Africa. Which countries are these criminals from, Robin?
We don't know, actually. But the interesting thing is we always think of Gaddafi in terms of the Arab world, when in fact he has been as much of a presence and nuisance in the African bloc. He had aspirations of, you know, leading the African world as well. He looks at both sides. And clearly, because of the instability in Africa, it's much more effective to bring in people who may not have loyalties to the Arab world that others might. And so that's a dynamic that's not original with Gaddafi. The Bahrainis have brought in foreigners as well.
David.
Yeah, he was actually leader of the African Union. I mean, he was elected leader of Africa, as it were. So this comes as a little surprise. He's a leading patron of many of these countries in Africa, funding huge public relief projects, mosques, things of that nature. So he's got some resonance in many of these countries.
All right. To, let's see, Jennifer in Tampa, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been following a Facebook group of Libyan expats and their discussion of what's going on. A couple of days ago, by the way, they were talking about the mercenaries and asking the same question, and several of them said that the mercenaries were speaking French, and they thought that they were from Chad, but I'm not sure about that. But that's what these expats were reporting. I had two questions for the panel. One was about the situation in Tripoli this morning. What I'm hearing, again, from this group of expats who are getting information from their relatives in Libya is they're talking about kind of a cleanup campaign in Tripoli right now, where Gaddafi's forces are trying to get the bodies off the street, trying to remove the graffiti, trying to wash away the blood, because supposedly the BBC is coming in and they want to present an image, they want to remove all the signs of violence that they can. I wanted to ask if the panel had heard anything about that. And I also wanted to get back to the earlier discussion about genocide, which, as I understand it, is a specifically targeted campaign against a nationality, against an ethnic group, against a group that can be identified in this way. I think that it's very easy in the West for us to use that term about Libya, and it refers to tribal things and things that we consider very ancient. But it seems to me that this conflict is actually much more of a political, economic conflict that doesn't meet that criteria of genocide. I certainly agree there's slaughter and bloodshed and horrid things, but I question the use of the term genocide.
All right. Thank you, Asma.
We can debate here the terminology, but for sure, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they've all come out saying that what is being committed here could constitute grounds for war crimes in Benghazi and in other cities. Now, why is he using these mercenaries? Because Gaddafi knows that at some point, Libyan soldiers and forces will not turn against their own people, because they will face their brothers, their sons, their fathers on the streets. So he is buying the loyalty of these mercenaries, paying them $12,000 per person they kill, per Libyan citizen they kill, and unleashing them on these unarmed civilians. I have not heard any report about cleaning up the streets, but I wouldn't be surprised. CNN yesterday announced that they already got Ben Weidman on the ground. I heard this morning the New York Times is sending somebody also. So a lot of reporters are going inside the country and trying to report back.
But we have to be careful. They're not in Tripoli. They're in eastern Libya, which has been, as they say, liberated. So no one that we know of in terms of Western press has managed to get into Tripoli. That there's a big difference. They've actually driven from Egypt.
All right. And here's an email from John asking a question I think a great many people are wondering about. He says, now that we hear the brutal practices of their leader throughout all these years, how can it be that our government has supported this regime and our so-called news media have ignored it, keeping the American people in the dark all for oil, David?
Well, I think it's hard to say that the United States government supported Gaddafi. I mean, they killed American troops. We responded with retaliation during the Reagan administration. They blew up a plane. We leveled multilateral sanctions against them that were really crippling. We only made a deal with them in 2003. In any event, it's not us who are getting Libyan oil. It's Italy. It's Spain. 10% of the oil goes to China. So it's not really us. I think it's mostly the Europeans who have made this type of deal.
It sounds as though you're creating very fine lines, Robin.
Well, look, the truth is we have made the deal with the devil, and we've done this over and over and over, and we have for 60 years in a lot of different places. We have done what is expedient, whether it's economically or strategically. We've been so scared in the aftermath of 9/11 that anybody who would cooperate with us on counterterrorism issues, we were prepared to look the other way when it came to basic human rights in their own countries. And that's a pattern that's been, again, repeated by Republicans and Democratic administrations throughout. So that's the real challenge for us right now, is to figure out how do you deal with these brutal regimes at a time that the historical forces are beginning to move in a different direction, and still protect the kind of interests we all have to stabilize economically. The price of oil is shooting through the roof now because of just the fears of potential consequences. And that's where any administration is concerned, particularly given the economic recession. There are no great choices right now.
And here's a request for clarification from Roger in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says in his televised speech, the son of Gaddafi distinguished among three groups involved in the protests and violence. They include protesters whose desire for democracy, he said, are legitimate and will be addressed, a second, an Islamist group, a third, criminals who were released from prison, given amnesty, who've taken weapons from the military and police stations. I'd like to know from your participants if this is accurate. Asma.
Actually, he did not say that those protesters, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi in his speech, did not say that the protesters' claims were legitimate. He said those were innocent, naive protesters who were trying to, quote-unquote, imitate the revolution in Cairo and in Tunis, and that that Libya is not Cairo or Tunis, and that they were being used. And also he said they were high on drugs and that they were drunk. What he said, actually, in the minds of many Libyans, really shattered any doubt that they had remaining that this person, Saif al-Islam, was capable of bringing change, prosperity, peace, or justice to the country. It only reinforced the perceptions they had of him and his dad.
Najla.
Well, I would add additional groups that Saif al-Islam actually mentioned besides those. He also implicated foreign elements. He implicated the Arab world. He implicated Al Jazeera and the BBC, the Libyan people, drugs. He mentioned ecstasy specifically on one occasion. He basically implicated or blamed everybody in the world except for the Gaddafi regime and the Gaddafi family. I mean, this was a last-ditch, I think, desperate attempt. I believe that the warnings, the fear-mongering, the warnings that Libya would be plunged into 40 years of civil war, that blood would flow, at the rivers of blood, these were scare tactics. I believe that he was when Muammar al-Gaddafi addressed quote unquote addressed the Libyan people, the Tunisian people after Ben Ali fled from Tunis, and said that there was nobody better than Ben Ali, and criticized the Tunisian people. A lot of Libyans thought he was really addressing the Libyan people. When Saif al-Islam addressed the Libyan people, in my opinion, a lot of it was an address to the West. So talk of Islamist groups, Islamic Emirates, statelets, separatist movements, these aren't ideas that are circulating in Libya. It's playing up on fears on both sides.
interesting, to Arlington, Virginia. Mukhtar, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Dean. Diane, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
What's happening in Libya is something that every decent person in the world supports, the demonstrators and the protesters. My concern is that both sides of the conflict, the Gaddafi dictatorship and the protesters, have been blaming foreigners, specifically Africans, without really in specifying which country are they from, or even showing any substantial evidence of that happening. I'm not disputing that it's happening. There probably are mercenaries. But we have to remember that there are hundreds of thousands of African refugees in Benghazi and Tripoli trying to make their way to Europe through Libya. And many of them are from my country. I'm from Eritrea. And my fear is that the xenophobia that is going to be created by such statements like Saif al-Islam, who blamed Africans as well as foreigners and Egyptians, and the protesters who are blaming Africans who are, killing protesters with live fire. I feel that the both sides or, reasonable people have to come out and say most of the African refugees are as, victims as everybody else.
All right, Najla.
Well, he brings up an important point, and David mentioned a few minutes ago that oil played an important role in sort of the weak response that Europe has had, and especially Italy has had, to what's happening in Libya. The other big issue, besides oil coming out of Libya, is immigration. Is this problem of illegal immigration? So Gaddafi sort of has one face towards Africa that's very adoring and sort of champions the cause of Africa and wants to be, quote unquote, the king of kings of Africa, whereas he turns to Europe and he says, I will stop the black whores, or I will unleash the black whores from Africa. So he's really engaging in doublespeak. But he has actual deals with European countries like Italy to stop the immigration. And Italy has paid him a lot of money to do that. And so that's another important factor in this, immigration and oil.
Najla Abdurrahman, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, Italy paid, I think, $40 billion in reparations for the occupation of Libya.
I think it was a lot less than that. I think it was more
and
like five.
It went directly to Gaddafi and his family, so I'm not sure if that really counts.
Yeah.
So the question remains, what do you want to see happen, Asma?
What I would like to see happen is I think the international community needs to stand up.
Excuse me. Apparently, Gaddafi is addressing state television now. Go right ahead.
I think the international community needs to stand up against Gaddafi and stop giving him excuses and unifying under the platform of upholding democracy and human rights and protecting human rights in countries worldwide, but now in Libya. People need to be allowed to say that, we want to the right to self-determination. We want democracy in Libya. We don't want corruption. We don't want deterioration in healthcare system. And we want to have a stable and secure country so that we can have a stable and secure region as well. The interests of the Libyan people coincide hand in hand with the interests of the U.S., and we have to keep that in mind.
And what do you hope to see the United Nations do?
I mean, I hope that they'll act. The thing is, again, everybody saw safe speech. He promised to fight till the last bullet. Everybody saw the absurdity that was Gaddafi's address yesterday, that we spoke about yesterday. When you see that level of delusion, of hubris, of just absolutely not caring what the rest of the world thinks of you, and you combine that with all the weapons, the military, the security forces, I mean, you're talking about a disaster here. If nobody acts, if nobody really does something, just more people are going to be slaughtered with impunity. He's going to fight to the death here.
David.
Yeah, this regime is appalling. I think the president, President Obama, should finally say, like he said with Mubarak, it's time to go. This cannot stand.
Apparently he is speaking defiantly as we speak. Robin, what do you believe could happen?
Well, I think Gaddafi, one way or another, is likely to be finished, whether it's politically or physically. This is a man who has taken a stand. It's going to be very difficult to sustain. The momentum is on the side of the people. It could become long and drawn out. It's unlikely that the international community is going to get involved militarily. It can take punitive measures, whether it's sanctions, cutting off oil purchases, a no-fly zone. There are a number of different options. But can anything be done quickly enough to assist or back implicitly even the Libyan people? It's really at this stage, as it was in Tunisia and Egypt, up to the people, more so than ever any time in history.
Robin Wright, David Schenker, Najla Abdulrahman, and Asma Megarif. Thank you all so much.
Thanks
for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.